Hello, happy housewives around the world. This is Darla Shine, happy housewife number one. I am here and back on schedule. The podcasts are back on every single day. And now that I'm back from my nightmare of a trip to Disney World that all you girls know about, and we got that killer virus, I had to have on our favorite physician, Dr. Furman. I'm so excited. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, Dr. Furman's website is drfurman.com, right? And your books, Disease Proof Your Child. Our moms are ordering that book. I know they're talking about it on the website. Eat to Live. We love that book, and I'm so excited you're here. Dr. Furman, I want to ask you some questions. So are you ready for the Ask the Doctor program here?
I'm ready.
Okay, so we went, the children and I, my mother, my nephew, my sister, on a big family trip to Disney World for Thanksgiving week. And when we got down there, the next day, my daughter Hannah started projectile vomiting all over the Magic Kingdom. By the next day, this, I guess it's called the stomach virus.
Right.
Diarrhea, vomiting. You know, my son had it, my nephew had it. And by the third day, I came back. We all came back. And then my husband got it, I got it, my mother, my father, my sister. How could we have picked up a virus so powerful that could have ran through the house? What do you think? It's the airplane? Do you think it's the airport? What was that? And how can you avoid something like that?
Well, I don't know for sure. I mean, most viruses are picked up through hand-to-mouth contact. In other words, you touch something, somebody's hand, a doorknob, you know, something they touched, a banister, you know, a railing, and then you put your hand to your mouth or your nose. And that's the way most people pick up viruses. So by washing your hands and keeping your hands away from your face is the best way to reduce the possibility of catching those things.
But how could it have spread through the whole household and then to my parents and my sister? You know, I have never experienced such a powerful virus that affected every single member of the family.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, once it's in your house, it's all over the place. I mean, it's hard to avoid. You know, the chance of getting a disease like that are dependent on various factors. One is the virulence of the virus. In other words, some viruses, a very small amount called the inoculum, can be contagious. And other viruses need a much larger dose to transmit the disease. So we call that the size of the inoculum, how much of the exposure. That's why by keeping your hands away from your mouth, it's hard to get enough of an inoculum just through the air. When somebody coughs on you, you have to be right on top of them to get that. And the next thing is the health of the host. In other words, the resistance of the host plays a huge role here. And the other, you know, there's other issues besides that, of course, and that's that whether the body saw that particular virus in the past and has immunomemory to it, if it had it in the past, it will be more resistant to it. It'll have a faster response. If it's a completely new virus to the whole area, to the whole family, then there's more chance you're all going to pick it up. So all these things play a role. And you know, what I focus on is the nutritional excellence that enables people to be more resistant. But it doesn't enable us to be completely disease-proof as far as picking up viruses, because keep in mind, I'm suggesting that there's some role viruses have to play in improving our health, that there's some good aspect to catching a virus. It's not all bad. You know, we use viruses in a symbiotic or beneficial relationship to help cleanse the body and remove free radicals and advanced glycation end products. In other words, when we take this period of time of eating lightly and throwing out waste and producing mucus and burning a fever and having diarrhea, you're actually in like a detoxification mode, a self-cleaning mode. As you throw the viruses out of the body, you're throwing out a lot of other waste products in the process, and you're giving the body an interlude of cleaning. So it may have beneficial effects on people's ultimate longevity, catching viruses here or there.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you if, when we were sick and my children were vomiting and I was vomiting, what is the first thing I do? I went to your website, drfurman.com. I'm looking on the internet. I'm trying to figure out what can be done. And basically, it was about 8 hours of violent vomiting, and then it was gone.
Hmm.
And what I'm confused about, and I have women on my website, Happy Housewives Club, who are asking this question, how can you know the difference? When do you need to go to the doctor? When do you need to get medicines or to look for treatment? And how can you tell if you have a virus that can't be treated, basically, or a bacteria or something that should be treated? How can you tell the difference?
Well, It's very easy, pretty much very easy. The main problem with getting a gastroenteritis, it's called, where we have diarrhea or vomiting, the main problem is dehydration. And the main problem is dehydration in the elderly or the young children. We don't want them to become dehydrated. So the major concern isn't the damage from the virus or the bacteria. The main concern is that a young child or an elderly person become dehydrated, and that's what will hurt them. So if we're putting out diarrhea and we're vomiting and we can't hold down fluids, that's a danger sign.
Well, how do you keep your baby or your child from becoming dehydrated? Because whatever you give them, they're just going to throw up.
Right, so that's the thing. So just imagine the digestive tract is like one of those balloons. You ever see those magicians who make balloon animals, those long, skinny balloons?
Right.
And they twist them into dogs and everything? Well, just imagine if we can take the balloon when it's deflated, no air in it, it's pretty thin. You know how thin it is, right?
Right.
Now, if we can squeak food down that balloon, liquid, little bit at a time, like a teaspoon every 5 minutes, and then a tablespoon or less, or a teaspoon every couple of minutes. In other words, to start out, if we stretch the balloon a little bit, and it triggers the nerves because the stomach is so sensitized now, and those nerves are triggered, it's going to cause us to vomit it back up again. But if we could almost put an IV down that into the mouth and drip fluid in there, drop, 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 one drop at a time, we're going to sneak the liquid through the digestive tract without stretching it, without weighting it down, without distending it, so that the digestive tract doesn't even know that there's fluid in it and you're not going to create vomiting. So the trick is just to give a little bit of fluid, very small amounts continually, and as you tolerate that more and more, you can give more and more gradually. But keep in mind that one sign of severe dehydration is the inability to take fluids down. So it gets to be a vicious cycle. When you get severely dehydrated, you could then anything you take in your body could cause vomiting.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So when you should go to the emergency room.
What type of fluid do you suggest? Because, you know, there's all these old wives' tales. Is it, you know, people say give ginger ale or give, what is with this Pedialyte and this Pedicare? I've never even bought that product.
No, I don't really recommend that either. I recommend people take regular old-fashioned orange juice and mix it with water. And then they put in, for every quart, they can put in a quarter teaspoon of salt and a quarter teaspoon of baking soda if they want to make their own Pedialyte. If the child's not that sick or dehydrated, you can just use half-dilute orange juice with nothing in it. Just orange juice and water is good enough.
Okay. So try and get that down. But when do you go to the emergency room?
If more than 24 hours goes by and you're not able to get fluid in your child, you have to go to the emergency room. 24 hours where you can't get fluid in. Right, sorry. The child's vomiting everything. The next day, you're not able to get fluid in, you got to go to the doctor. You shouldn't really have your child go for more than a day without holding any fluid down. But it really almost never has to be the case because you really can take a little bit of fluid down. And we can trick the body. The parents just have to know how to do this correctly.
So just a little bit at a time.
Right.
Right. Okay,
and,
next question.
And the other thing, the question about how do you know it's bacterial, how do you know it's viruses, and the answer is whether the stool is bloody or not. If you have blood in the stool, then you should see a doctor and have a stool analysis to consider a bacterial infection like salmonella. If it's just diarrhea and the child's okay, it's okay, and the child's being hydrated, you can let it go. If it's persistent, of course, and not improving after 3 days, it's another time to go see a physician to be analyzed to what the problem is.
Okay, I have another question from one of our moms. She wants to know, how can she tell the difference between food poisoning or a stomach flu or a stomach virus?
Well, you don't have to really know the difference because food poisoning is a stomach flu or a stomach virus because we could get a bacterial gastroenteritis or a viral gastroenteritis, and we can also call them food poisoning because they can really come from some type of bacteria or virus that was on the food that the person handling the food touched the food, they didn't wash their hands well, or you got it from person to person. Whether it's food poisoning or whether it's poisoning from working in a daycare center and changing a kid's diaper, you get it. It's still really this pretty much the similar thing.
So it doesn't matter.
The same thing holds. It has to do with how severe the condition is, whether it's bloody, and if there's diarrhea and vomiting both, that's usually a sign of food poisoning or a severe gastroenteritis. And there's still nothing we have to do as long as we can keep the child or yourself hydrated with fluid.
Okay. Now, is it flu season, Dr. Furman, right now?
We're having a very mild, it's the start of the flu season coming up this month, you know, the end of next month. But right now we're in the very beginnings and it's very, very mild.
It's mild. Now, I have a bunch of women who are in a particular part of my website who have been going back and forth discussing whether or not they should give their children the flu vaccination. Now, I feel I have never given my children the flu vaccination. But what do you think about that? And if you were going, these women who plan on doing it, isn't it just too late now anyway?
It's not too late, because they pick in the flu vaccine, they pick the organisms that are best for that year. But keep in mind, the flu vaccine only lasts for the 1 year, and then new viruses come into play the following year. So it's not like they get one vaccine and they're good for 10 years. This is like repeat a vaccine every year.
Right. That's what they're doing. I think that, you know, this everyone's gone vaccine crazy.
I agree. You know, can you imagine giving your child a vaccine every single year over and over again? We give them too many vaccines as it is. And, you know, it doesn't just contaminate their body with the mercury or other toxic ingredients of the vaccines, but there's all kinds of preservatives and formaldehydes and all kinds of alcohols, things you're injecting directly into the blood besides the flu virus. See, I vaccinate my kids with nutritional excellence.
Right.
And when they get sick, they're back into school or back there well within 1 day or 2 days the most. I think my daughter Kara is sick right now today at home, but I've never seen her miss more than 1 day of school.
Right. Well, you know, when the body is strong, you can bounce back quickly.
They bounce back so quickly, it's amazing.
Right.
And you know, when exposure to these viruses may have it's certainly a better effect on them than exposing them to the vaccines over the long term.
Right.
And the worst thing, of course, is exposing them to antibiotics.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. This is my big question before we get on to solutions. Strep throat. I feel like everybody I know, their child has strep throat, and if they don't have it this week, they're going to have it next week. And constant antibiotics.
Right.
What is with this surgence of strep throat, and why does everyone have it? And I feel like it's becoming resistant to every antibiotic out there. So what do we do?
That's true. I mean, first of all, you know, let's put this in perspective. That we have to recognize that antibiotics are not benign, they're not harmless, they're very dangerous, or I could say even deadly drugs. And the more antibiotics you take, the higher the risk of breast cancer, let's say. Antibiotics are linked to breast cancer, they're linked to allergies
and asthma. Wait a
minute,
I have never heard this, Dr. Furman.
You never heard that? I even mentioned it a few times in my book, Disease Proof Your Child. I talked about all the downside of these recurrent antibiotics, but definitely the medical literature shows that the more antibiotic doses you've taken, the higher the risk of breast cancer. That's just one example of the dangers of antibiotics. They're serious drugs, and then, you know, they can create life-threatening, and even people die from the use of antibiotics. It's not something.
I don't think anyone thinks it's a serious drug. I see moms constantly popping these antibiotics and having them, and even people will take old antibiotics. My father, if something's wrong with him, he'll pull out an antibiotic from his closet he's had for 20 years and take it.
Wow. Well, do you know that 92% of antibiotics are being used for infections that they don't work on? In other words, they're given for viral infections, for things like bronchitises, which don't respond, and they're given inappropriately. We could say the antibiotics are mostly used for malpractice. They're not used for infections in which they even help. And sure, you know, I'm all for the use of antibiotics for a life-threatening or serious infection, but I'm not for them being used for things that could resolve on their own because they're dangerous drugs. And the problem is it creates a vicious cycle, because the more antibiotics you use, the more it diminishes your immune strength, the more it kills out the good bacteria that create nutrients in your body and protects you against other bacteria from invading us, and more it creates yeast overgrowth, the more it weakens our in other words, it selects out for more dangerous organisms to infect us in the future. It makes us get sicker. It makes us need more antibiotics in the future. The more you take, the more you need. It keeps our kids on this antibiotic sickness merry-go-round. And to me, it's a very sad experience that people bring their children to doctors and get given antibiotics when they didn't need them, and they get sicker and sicker and sicker because of it.
Well, do you need – my daughter Hannah, a couple of weeks ago, maybe last month, had strep throat.
Right.
And I did not want to give her antibiotics. And my mother kept insisting that for strep throat, you need to be on antibiotics.
And why did your mother say that? Let's go through the reasoning here, okay?
I don't know. I guess she's been taught this by society. And her quote was this: Grandma got a bad heart from not taking antibiotics when she had strep throat and she got rheumatic fever.
Right. So let's look at that for a minute, okay? Because clearly, one thing is true, is that strep throat gets well in about 4 to 5 days without antibiotics and about 3 to 4 days with antibiotics. In other words, you don't lose more than a day or two. It resolves without it. The reason people recommend antibiotics for strep throat is because of the fear of getting rheumatic fever. The only problem is that the Center for Disease Control has kept records on the cases of rheumatic fever caused by strep. And don't forget, for every person treated with antibiotics for strep throat, there's more people with sore throats that aren't treated with antibiotics. So we know that there's a certain percent of people that we could look at the incidence of rheumatic fever across the country in every state. And we see that there's been no recorded cases of rheumatic fever in the east coast of the United States, east of the Mississippi, in the last 10 years, not one case.
So that's the only reason we're putting on antibiotics for strep throat?
And what I'm saying to you is that the strain of strep that's around infecting kids today is not the strain that used to be that was related to rheumatic fever that used to infect strep, and it may come back again some year. And we should and the Center for Disease Control should monitor this and instruct us when strep is the strain that's linked to rheumatic fever, and that's to be appropriate to treat. But right now, since it's been already 10 years, there's been no cases, I think we're not taking a risk of not using an antibiotic for strep.
That is amazing. I love you, Dr. Furman, because let me just tell you a story, and I'm almost afraid to say this on the radio, but I'm going to say it anyway. One of my close girlfriends, my group of girlfriends are mostly holistic and organic like I am and try to be. I was with her the other day, and let me tell you this story. You're not going to believe it. Her son went to she took her son to the pediatrician. Now, this lady, her husband is a physician, just to give you that. She takes him to the pediatrician because his glands were huge. He had, you know, this horrible sore throat. So she brought her son to the pediatrician. He said, okay, he has strep throat. And so she went home, and she never filled the prescription for antibiotics because she said, okay, I'm not going to give him the antibiotics.
Right.
You know, and she was trying to heal him holistically and giving him herbs and garlic and all these, you know, great things. Make a long story short, the doctor called up to see if she had, you know, filled the prescription. And then he sent the police to her house. Do you know that she was arrested? She was taken downtown. Her husband had to get her out of it they have a lawyer now. Did you ever hear of this kind of craziness?
What? She was arrested for not giving her kid an antibiotic?
The doctor said that she was putting her child at risk, that actually, and the strep had gone into the child's blood, and that the child would have died. This is what the doctor is saying.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think that what happened was she had made a comment in the office, you know, you could give me the prescription, but I'm not going to fill it anyway.
Right.
You know?
Right,
and
right.
I guess that made him upset. And make a long story short, this actually happened. So, you know, it ended up that the whole thing was dropped. She didn't get charges pressed against her. But she had to put her son in the hospital for 2 days and get antibiotics under the doctor's care. She was hysterical.
Well, listen, you know, it's called sepsis when you have bacteria in the blood. And the only way the doctor could have known that is with a blood culture, which takes a few days to culture out. You know, that's not, in other words, if the child would be profoundly sick, hardly able to move or lift his head up, so that's a very serious thing that the doctor is proposing. It sounds like he lied to impose his will. Because how would he know if the child is septic? And septic is a very serious condition.
I don't know, but the point I'm trying to make is, you know, I think so many mothers are terrified, afraid. I mean, here I am, you know, sneaking around with my daughter who doesn't have the chickenpox vaccination, afraid that, you know, one day the school's going to find out.
Right,
she's
right.
Going to be kicked out, you know.
It's just unbelievable that we've allowed their political system. We worship the drug industry and the medical profession as our gods, and it's like we live in a religious state where they control our decisions about our own children, our own body, and if we don't follow the party line, we get our kids taken away or somebody comes after us to arrest us.
Right, which is exactly
Isn't this unbelievable?
It's scary.
We don't no longer have the rights to our own body anymore.
No, it's scary. It's terrifying. But what could you tell us? What can we do when our child does have strep throat and we don't want to put them on antibiotics? What natural remedies in food and nutrition would take the place of that, would, you know, help strengthen their throat and get rid of that bacteria or virus?
Well, you know, I wrote a book about this called Disease Proof Your Child. You know that.
Right.
And I talk about how the immune system is a very complicated and, you know, very complex interactive system. And it takes time to build immunity because you actually have to get nutrients down to the tissue level, which takes about 2 to 3 months of eating healthfully to do so. In other words, the child's immunity, their ability to get well rapidly and not have something turn more serious, you can't do something. You can't suddenly change over and build an immune system in a day or two by giving just vitamin C or garlic or echinacea or all these things. It's not going to have a revolutionary effect on rebuilding the child's immune system if the child has not been eating healthfully all along. We really have to get our kids to eat, you know, fruits and vegetables. And you guys must know that kids who eat lots of fresh fruit have a 40% lower risk of cancer as an adult. When
right.
they eat more fruit when they're young. Kids who eat green vegetables, for example, have a 60% lower risk of cancer when they're adults. In other words, we have to get kids to eat particularly different color vegetables, especially greens, all the time. And so I could make my kids a healthy shake. Like I made them a shake yesterday morning with cherries, with frozen cherries, and we put a teaspoon of natural cocoa in it, and then we threw in a head of kale, and we whipped up the frozen cherries, the cocoa. I think we put a little pomegranate in too, and we whipped it up. And
that sounds yummy.
It was a chocolate cherry shake. They didn't know the greens were in it. It was a red color. Nobody knew they were getting a dose of raw kale blended in. They just didn't even know. You know. And then then at nighttime comes, and my kids are eating a delicious vegetable soup with, you know, split pea soup or something with little pieces of corn, toasted cornbread in it, and it was really delicious. And they didn't even know that we had spinach and bok choy whipped into the soup. They didn't even see it in the soup. There's so many ways we can get greens into our kids. We even make them a cake, and we make them the cake out of carrots and beets with a little bit of dates and a little bit of oatmeal and raisins in there and shredded apples. And the whipped cream for the cake, the whipped cream we make from macadamia nuts, soy milk, and dates. In other words, there's so many ways we can get healthy food into our children. And I measure the kids. I take my kids and I measure their nutrient scores. Like I'll put their hand into a carotenoid scanner and I'll say, you know, let's see how high your number is. And I'll say, oh, it's 50,000. You're eating great. Keep up the good work. And I'll say to my son, Sean, you know, Sean, you're eating more green vegetables than me. I can't have you get stronger than me. You know, but in other words, we make it taste great and then we measure them to see how much nutrients they have in their tissues. And I'm just not, when you give people echinacea, it's a stimulant for white blood cell activity. But just activating white blood cells to make them move around and demarginate doesn't really give you the same defenses as if they've been activated because their white blood cells are well nourished. You have to have the glucosinolates and isothiocyanates in the white blood cells to begin with, and that can only come from the consumption of green vegetables.
Right. Well, there has to be a proper diet in everyday living, which I am constantly on my mom's about. I want them to cook for their children and, you know, cook fresh foods and give them fresh, raw fruits and vegetables every single day.
Right.
But when you are, I mean, if you are eating healthfully, because I have to tell you, I truly believe this. When my children even begin to get a cold, I make a big pot of homemade chicken soup. I put every vegetable under the sun in there, including kale and lots of garlic. And then I make them drink some wheatgrass juice. I really feel like by the end of the day, they are snapped back because of that. Maybe I'm hallucinating, but maybe it's because every day they're eating fruits and vegetables.
Maybe, but you know this. But one thing we do know is that when they're sick, if they eat too much food, you'll prolong the sickness. In other words, it is true to say starve a cold, and it should say starve a cold and starve a fever. In other words, when you're sick, your powers of digestion go down. And if they eat mucus, if they eat things like dairy products and wheat and bread, you know, and cola, and in other words, the more junk they eat, you're really going to make it worse.
So this is a good tip. When a child has a fever, we're not supposed to give them anything?
No, you know, nature takes away our appetite naturally. We eat less when we're sick. We lose our hunger when we're sick. And we shouldn't be giving them things that are hard to digest when they're sick. Like meat and dairy and heavy things to digest, cheese, you know, cream cheese. We should be giving them a light diet of an orange juice and some vegetable soup, you know. And if they're hungry later, a little salad. In other words, give them very light, easy to digest. You know, the less they eat, the better. Don't worry about them losing weight. Let them get well fast. Don't stuff them with food.
I want to ask you another question. I thought at least 2 or 3 years ago that I read that in the American Medical Journal that they had finally said that antibiotics do not help ear infections. But I am still seeing women go to the doctor when the child has an ear infection and getting antibiotics.
Well, they didn't. That's not what they said. What they're saying is that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Family Physicians have come out with joint guidelines. They're actually agreeing with each other. And they're actually agreeing with me, too, for once in the last 10 years, right? They're saying that the risks of antibiotics is so great, and since the vast majority of ear infections resolve on their own, that they've determined that the risks of the antibiotics are greater than the risks of the ear infection being untreated. And they gave guidelines of when to treat with antibiotics and when not to treat. And to simplify it, it basically says that if your child has pain, treat the pain with something, but don't treat it with an antibiotic. Only if fever and pain continue for more than 3 days with the signs of a bacterial infection would an antibiotic be appropriate. So by using it for 3 days, letting it continue without being treated for 3 days, because by that time, more than 80% of them start to improve without an antibiotic. So unless it doesn't start to improve, then you can go to a doctor and get an antibiotic. So that's essentially in the guidelines. And they've studied that, and they found out using these protocol, we can decrease the use of antibiotics in children by over 80% of less use of antibiotics following these new guidelines. But that doesn't mean doctors follow it. Doctors still don't listen to the guidelines of their own governing organizations. You follow me?
I follow you. I think that it's, you know, there's so much information here. I could talk to you every single day and just be amazed by some of the things you tell me. I want all of my moms to read Disease Proof Your Child by Dr. Furman and Eat to Live, two books that you have to have in your household. Dr. Furman, I know you're a busy man, so you go and see your patients. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks, Dollar, and have a great holiday season.
Okay, and we'll have you back on before the holidays are in full swing. But before we go, I want you to give just my moms three things that they need to start doing tomorrow in their household, start feeding their children.
Well, number one, they should make a vegetable soup, a vegetable bean soup every single week. And, you know, once you make a big pot of soup, you have it leftovers 3 to 4 days. You got the whole. It's a time saver. And put some vegetable juice, fresh squeezed vegetable juice, into the base of the soup. That's the secret. You put carrot juice. You put celery juice. You put tomato juice. You put beet juice. You have a juicer, and you fresh squeezed juices in the vegetable base of your vegetable soup. So it's half water and half vegetable soup. And then the next thing is, make a nice sorbet in a high-quality blender where you use frozen fruit whipped with little flax seeds or whipped with a little bit of, you know, like a, you know, some little bit of dried fruit like raisins. Like mix, for example, frozen strawberries with a piece of dried pineapple, a little orange juice, and get rid of the unhealthy desserts and start to learn how to make desserts themselves that your children look forward to that are like the anti-cancer healthy desserts. Get rid of the junk food desserts and get on with the great-tasting healthy desserts.
And what's number three?
Number three?
Yes.
I guess number three is that we need those omega-3 fatty acids. They build intelligence in our children. They build the immune system. And the lignans, the fibers in flax seeds, have very powerful effects against breast cancer. So adding a little bit of seeds, sesame seeds, sunflower seeds, especially flax seeds, into a shake, into a smoothie, into an ice cream is a third critical thing. And, of course, at drfurman.com, we have a little bit of DHA purity in dropper form, which is that fish fat. But we get DHA purity not from fish. It's vegetable-derived. It has no taste. We keep it refrigerated so it's very pure with no rancidity. And a little extra DHA into your diet fuels intelligence in your children and builds the immune system. So if you do all those things I just said, little extra DHA for the immune system and for the brain development, flax seeds and other seeds, fresh fruit sorbets because berries are superfoods, and the vegetable soups with the cruciferous vegetables in with the vegetable juice bases, then you've gotten the centerpiece of the anti-cancer lifestyle.
Well, I love this. Ladies, let's get on board. Let's start doing this. Make your children strong. Disease proof your child, yourself. Eat to live. Dr. Furman, thank you, and we will talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you, Dora. Have a great week.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.